Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawai and Scott Wigand, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
Today, we're going to do something a little different. All of us at Valley College have been affected by the murder of George Floyd and the weeks of protests and the images of police brutality. I am joined today with my usual co-host, Scott Wigand, Director of the Academic Resource Center, and Lynette Martin, the Associate Dean of Student Services, who is also our Student Equity Coordinator. All three of us were moved to have a public dialogue on our thoughts of this important moment in our nation's history. We would like Valley College to be a safe place to speak about how we move forward issues of race in our local community, state, and country. Before we move forward, I'd like to lay down some basic ground rules for our listeners. These are our own opinions. They are not the official opinion of the college. Each of us are coming to these issues with different lived experiences and our own biases. There are two ways of dealing with race in a large institution. One is to ignore it. For the last 50 years, we see that there's a limit to the progress that can be made by being colorblind. The whole idea that I don't see race, I just see people, and all analysis should be limited to that level. The other way is to look at it unapologetically of how race affects how we interact with the world. If we're going to talk about race and inequity, we're going to have to be accepting that we're going to disagree in some places, and we may have ignorance in certain topics. We welcome dialogue to help patch those blind spots. We ask that you listen to this conversation knowing that we don't have all the answers, but we'd like to see change happen and are open to start one, hopefully, one of many similar discussions on campus. Welcome to the podcast, Lynette. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Scott. Okay.
So why don't we give a quick summary of sort of our background in this issues of race and equity. Scott, why don't you go first? Because when Lynette explains her background, we're going to be a little embarrassed.
Yeah, probably makes sense with the privileged white male as far as background goes. So, you know, for me, my lived experiences are really just that of you know, middle class privileged white male. My educational background and just sort of environment is where I, in terms of where I grew up, from small towns in Colorado to conservative areas in California. You know, certainly colored and informed my perspective on all things considered. As I worked my way through colleges, both Cal State's, the super progressive college at UC Santa Cruz, my experiences were certainly changed by my time at those different places too. You know, and as I come to the conversation now, working at Valley College for the last 18 years, it's truly been the opportunity that I've had to work in a diverse institution and have had the opportunity really through the college to participate in this discussion and take action and do work that I think has a more meaningful contribution to the community.
And then Lynette, how about you? Every time I have a conversation with you, there's always something where I go like, I never even considered that. So why don't you tell us about your background in this fight?
Sure. And I'm glad you asked that question because I was hoping to preface everything that I say today. And I appreciate your introduction in that these are not the opinions or perspectives of the college and that they are deeply rooted within our own identities. And so to start, I'd like to share my positionality in all of this work as a Mexican American female and daughter of immigrants who grew up in the 80s and 90s in Koreatown. I have a specific, not unique, but a specific take on the experiences that we're currently living and how they those experiences shape the way I view this current event. As a daughter of working class immigrant parents who were often marginalized and shamed for lack of speaking the language or because we lived in a working class community, you know, having had to translate for my parents whenever they needed translation in an official government setting, whether that would be a dentist or the Medi-Cal office, which was kind of our a government public health insurance plan that we had. And so I benefited from being bilingual. And so to this day, being bilingual is super important to me. In fact, I'm training my dog to be bilingual. He's pretty good. I just think that that allows me to connect with different communities. And so my experiences and my identity definitely forms the opinions that I have about this specific time. And I will say that the 1992 LA uprising was something that, despite being a very young person, it gave me pause and it made me realize that there was a whole lot of difference in the way that different people were treated. And I paused because I didn't want to say hate, because I don't know that hate quite encapsulates what there is. It's just difference and not understanding of the differences they create to miscommunication and make it difficult for folks to come together and speak from maybe a place of love and care. And I'm not dismissing the institutional and structural racist fabric that this nation was founded on. I'm not ignoring that, but I am saying that having grown up in a diverse place in LA and having lived some of the tensions of the LA uprising in 92, what I saw as a young person was that we just did not communicate with each other. Growing up in Koreatown, heavily immigrant community from different walks of life. And each immigrant community basically held to their own. Today's Koreatown is a much different place and I love it. But back then, you know, if you were a Mexican immigrant child, you hung out with Mexican immigrant children and the Korean immigrant children hung out with those Korean immigrant children. And so there was a lot of separation. And I think that created a lot of the tension, again, from a 10-year-old's perspective. Lo and behold, as I was bused into suburban schools for better education, which again was my parents' perspective, that if I was sent out to a different school, and they didn't call it better because it was more white. They just, what little they knew was that this school far away was a better school. It had a better reputation. I'd be lying if I said my parents looked at, you know, the scores that each school had, but they knew by perception and by word of mouth that the local schools were not preparing the children to go on and excel in education. So my parents put us on buses, all seven of us, for 7 years of our lives, 2 hours a day, so that we could have a better education. I don't quite remember whether I thought that was unfair then, but I didn't like it. So I think that those early experiences really started framing the way I engaged with different people. And I think that I say that because I am surrounded by a rich diversity of friends and colleagues. And I tend to excel and be a much happier person when I am surrounded by diverse types of people and get to exchange in ideas. And so I pursued an educational career that eventually led me to work specifically in a community college, because by this point, fast forward many years, having had kind of an inclination toward the inequities that are systemic and the differences that sometimes don't get addressed because we're not talking to each other, those things combined led me to a work that I do now. And it was not by default that I ended up the person leading our student equity efforts at the college. It was very much intentional. I prepared, I chased academic preparation that would allow me to have the ability to think through how do we chip away at years and years of systemic inequality. And for me, the answer kept coming back to becoming an administrator who's able to have a seat at the table to be able to shed light on some of the things that the people in the room don't see and don't understand, not because they're bad people necessarily, but sometimes because it's not their lived experience. And so sure, that's how I come to this work.
So my background's a little different. Now, whenever you talk about race, you get into this caveat game where you go, I'm saying this and I'm not implying this and I'm not implying this and I'm not saying that. And I'm just going to preface this by saying the Asian American experience is not the Black experience. It's not the Hispanic experience. And that's the last caveat I'll give. So my family's been in the U.S. for 150 years. We are Japanese American in heritage. They've gone back and forth in terms of Japan, U.S., Japan, U.S. So as you grow up, you hear about these stories of your grandfather, your great grandfather, and how they had to get around being Japanese. They couldn't get microloans. They couldn't buy land. All the different little tactics that you had to do to sort of survive for the last 150 years. So all of what's happening is familiar. It's not the same as what I grew up, but the idea of systemic racism was something that is part of your family history. It is part of your history and part of you, your being raised. It is what you are sort of taught to say as an Asian, how do you interface with this economy? What are the right majors for you and the right jobs? And where are the jobs where you are disadvantaged? Now, my father in the 60s and 70s and 80s was a closet peace activist, meaning that, you know, he had a job. He was a manager of a bank, of a large Japanese corporational bank. And even though he was pro-Japanese American rights and pro-peace, that is not a place to be pro-peace. It is a conservative Japanese bank, anti-communist and all the things that come with that. He wanted to use his position to sort of further the movement, but he had to be quiet about it. So he wasn't a guy who went to protest, but he was a guy who gave banking opportunities to people who were hippies. So hippies weren't given banking accounts, and he would give them bank accounts, and they would walk into the bank and they'd look at him, and he'd be with a old Japanese businessman, and they'd look at him, they'd give him the power salute, and my dad would just be like, hey man, don't get me fired. So within Little Tokyo, he was always trying to like find ways to like navigate how to move opportunities for Japanese forward. So one sort of story that he gave me a long time ago sort of defines that narrative and also defines how I look at this problem. At the time, someone wanted to create the Asian American Drug Abuse Program. In the 70s and 80s, when Japanese Americans got high and had a drug abuse problem, when they sort of talked about their lived experience, it was very different from the other people in the drug abuse programs. And someone wanted to create a program just for people in that community. So when they went to go get matching funds from one of the largest sort of charity organizations, they said, no, sorry, you don't need it because first of all, Japanese people, they're not drug addicts. Second of all, Japanese people are really good at taking care of themselves. So we're not going to give you matching funds. So my father did was he went and called every large Japanese corporation that was in Los Angeles, Honda, Toyota, Panasonic, Sony. And he said, I want you to pledge $1 million to this charity. So every one of those charities pledged $1 million. And he goes, don't worry, you're not going to give it to them. And then a week later, he told them, okay, now call them and said, we just found out that you don't give charity money to Japanese American organizations. So we are now pulling our pledge. So every one of those companies pulled their pledge, Nissan, Honda, Toyota, Panasonic, Sanyo. So then that national charity organization came looking for my dad saying, oh my God, we've got to give you money. We've got to give you matching funds because we got to get that money back. So my father gave the man who started the program a loan for the full amount that they wanted. They matched it, and the next day, he gave back the loan back to my dad, no interest because it's one day. And then that drug abuse program still lasts to this day. It's still there. It still exists. I still hear people working with them. It's a really good success story. It's been around for, I think, the 80s. And my father has story after story where, for example, the East-West Players, which is the first premier Asian-American theater troupe, where a lot of just Asian Americans got their start. My father also part of the funding there. And he has all these funny stories of, yeah, they wouldn't give us money. We had to figure out a way to get money. We couldn't get this land. We had to figure it out. So my whole background in this is just sort of listening to my father's little war stories of how in the background he was working on it. There was a lot of Briar Rabbit in him. where he was trying to sort of trick the man into progress. And then that's how I tend to look at this fight. Now, let's talk about what's happening right now. I remember calling my mother and she said, you know what? I've seen a lot of protests in my life going back to the Watts riots. This one feels different. And then shockingly, I was listening to the George Floyd funeral, and Al Sharpton was saying, this is different. Surprisingly, Tallahassee Coates, I just listened to an interview with him, who is usually the most negative person on the potential for progress in terms of race. And he said, this time feels different. He talked to his dad, who was a former Black Panther, and he goes, son, this has not happened before. So do you have any thoughts about why this is different or what's different this time?
So I did share that I got to witness the LA uprising and got to learn about it later because I became very interested in learning about it from an adult perspective rather than, you know, my child eyes. And I too, from the minute I started getting emails and texts and calls to action from some of my most apolitical friends, who some are white, some are Asian, some are Black, some are Latinx, but albeit, and I shared that I tend to lean toward a very political leaning. Some of these friends are not. And so when they started messaging me, I knew it was different because that meant that different people who usually are comfortable in the sidelines because of whatever layers of privilege they may have. And I'll share that I believe that we all have some layers of privilege that may or may not be constant, maybe not at the larger systemic institutional level. But, you know, some of their privilege allows them to not have to participate in these conversations. And previously, they hadn't chosen to. I will share that the one that struck me the most was from a friend that I had who I grew up with and who was one of my friends who is white and grew up in an upper middle class community. And I met her when I was in middle school and high school, and to this day we're very close friends. And when she sent me a message, I knew it was different because she is as apolitical as they come. And so the reason why I think it's different is that different people who have previously been able to just allow another horrific killing of a Black man to just pass as whatever's on the nightly news, this was not that case. And I don't know why it triggered their gut reaction to become involved, but I'm happy it did. And so that's what I think is different about it.
How about you, Scott? Has this been different for you at all, or from what you've seen?
Very different. You know, as Annette was sharing the 92 riots, I was thinking back to my experience with that, which was very, very different. I was in Simi Valley, where the trial took place. So, you know, Simi Valley is a very conservative, Republican, white city. And, you know, it was touted and liked to tout itself as the safest city in the country. And I think it had received, you know, that award a number of years. So when I think back to those 92 riots, from the perspective of where I was at in high school and as the verdict came down and the riots unfolded, you know, in Simi Valley, there was this supposed threat and worry that there was going to be a riot in Simi or that people from LA were going to come over into Simi. And so, you know, there was concerns about that. And oh my gosh, you know, what's the police going to do? This, that, and the other. Nothing happened. It was purely everyone's fear and sort of watching through the TV about what was taking place in LA.
I feel like the police have been very blatant on this one. I mean, I have never seen so many just police shooting the media, just being brazen about it. And I think we've had 4 years of people blaming the media, right? Of the media being anti-American, and it looks like some of the cops believe it because I've never seen such blatant, let's just shoot the media, which has been shocking to me.
I think the big difference there, John, too, so that was my experience in 92. Now, as the events have unfolded around us in the last, you know, 3 weeks here, Simi Valley, you know, which is again, as I described, it's kind of notorious as cop town as well, because it's Ventura County. It's right on the border between LA and Ventura County. And so a lot of LAPD lives in Simi Valley. And then they drive over the hill and they work in Los Angeles, and a lot of LAPD has retired in Simi. Mm-hmm. And so yet again, here came all the threats and the concerns about Antifa is coming to Simi. There's going to be mass rioting, protesting, you know, all the stores, everybody board up your windows, that sort of thing. Simi had a protest. It was last Saturday. I don't exactly recall what the numbers were, but they were big. There was a big turnout of people, and there was a march across city that ended up at City Hall. It actually been coordinated and organized. I think it was by a high school student who put it together for Simi. But the coming together of everybody in the city here and demonstrating together and showing their support for George Floyd's family and just the movement in general was night and day compared to what it was in 92. And that's just a very small, you know, kind of snapshot about a time and a place in a city here. But if we kind of circle back from that and look at the bigger picture of it, the thing that seems so different to me that, you know, Yannette was speaking to and that you're speaking to, John, and I speak to my mom, too, who lived through the Watts riots, lived in Inglewood. It's the scope and the magnitude of how far reaching the protests are. And I think a lot of it, you know, is obviously fueled by technology and by the cell phones. And so the ability to capture what we're seeing, whether it's the police brutality, you know, with actually capturing the footage of George Floyd, or the footage that we see with all the protests, you know, we're getting a perspective on that that we never would have had before, as it would have been filtered by the mainstream media. And so, you know, just as people aren't looking necessarily to CNN and CBS and whatever it is to get their news, if you plug into Twitter, you're going to find, you know, 10,000 other videos that were filmed on the street about what's actually going on. And that paints a completely different picture than I think we ever would have seen before.
I was just going to add, I think in hearing you speak, Scott, about, you know, your geographic location during the LA uprising and my geographic location, and feeling, you know, two seemingly different communities feeling the same type of fear that someone, some obscure group was going to come and destroy the loving communities that we had. And I have to attribute that to, having studied, journalism. I have to attribute it to the sensationalization of the media. I've seen in this instance, to your point, Scott, that people cannot ignore this is happening, and people are showing, through protests, peaceful and otherwise, that we're all in this. This is an ill of society. And I think that's another difference, that it's not just self-contained in South LA, Koreatown, and Simi during the trial. It's happening all over the country and all over the world. And people are recognizing the deep-seated racist histories of multiple countries. As a Mexican woman, I can tell you there are parts of Mexico that are very racist. And it's not just geographic parts. It's different thinking about phenotype, which, you know, we know is you know, race being a social construct and therefore putting people into positions of privilege and otherwise. We've seen that in France, where there's, you know, the Black French are talking about their experience, albeit not quite as brutal as maybe we've seen in the United States. There is prejudice and some very hurtful and systemic negative impact from being other than phenotypically white and male. And so we're now calling it that. And I feel very strong in saying that we haven't been that comfortable in labeling it that, because it's been very hard to get the backlash of, well, I'm not racist. I'm not prejudiced. I love all kinds of people. And so it shuts down the conversation, makes it really hard to move past it and get to a place of maybe some common understanding. And so I feel like that's a little different too. We're much more, willing to talk about it and willing to admit that we might be wrong in our perspective or wrong in our full comprehension, but that we're at least engaging in dialogue.
Yeah, I think there are more people who feel allied in this sense of inequity, because we're seeing the number of of rural whites in terms of drug use and in terms of suicides, we see that exploding. And we are probably in the most inequitable right. moment in our history. It's not clearly defined by race, but it's combined by just economic power. I had sort of, so there's this typical list of why people think that the protests have been so global and so diverse. It has to do with the pandemic. It has to do with people not having jobs. It has to do with younger people being used to protesting after Parkland. And also a lot of the leaders of the global warming have been children. So then for me, I have sort of like two other sort of outside ideas of why it's been so diverse. There's this guy called Jerome Lanier, who is a computer philosopher. He's one of the original computer guys. He coined the word virtual reality. And he's just been a guy who has always been on the cutting edge of technology. And rather than just doing it, he's been one of those people who looks 20 years from now what happens because of it. Now, he has this philosophy that, you know, we had this hope that social media would be this sort of transparency platform where we would be able to democratize protests. And for a long time, he felt as if the counter protest was always bigger than the original protest. So the alt-right came out of an argument between what was called Gamergate, which was a few girls who broke up with a guy and would talk about the misogyny of people who play video games. And that whole sort of thing exploded into the alt-right. When we look at Arab Spring, it did change Egypt, but then it did make the rest of the Middle East more authoritarian. If we look at the hope and change of Obama, it created a much more lasting Tea Party. When you look at Black Lives Matter, right, the rebound was Trump. I think this is a rebound off of sort of the MAGA. This is the first time where the counter protest was progressive. I think for a long time, you could compartmentalize race. Like you could use race to make someone who was not of color feel comfortable. Say, yeah, we're not paying you a lot of money, but at least you're not them. And then what happened was as the Democratic Party became 95% of the vote for the Democratic Party became African-American, 70% support from the Hispanic community, overwhelming support from the gay community, that you started seeing the Democratic Party as the minority party, even though that there were a lot of educated whites that also made up a large part of the Democratic Party. And the same things that happened to people of color year after year after year, stealing a Supreme Court seat, profiting off a government, gerrymandering, voter suppression, that was now happening to white people. Like when you talk about that, like, oh, I totally know what that is. So whenever I talk to white Democrats, I go, I don't recognize this America. And I go, like, I know what this America is. This America has been going on for 120 years of my family's life. And just so you know, this is the best it's ever been. If you ask me to trade places with 20 years ago of my parents or 50 years ago of my grandparents, I'll tell you that my situation now with the sort of unfairness that we're seeing in terms of the gerrymandering and the voter suppression, we've never had it so good. So I think this is the first time where we have sort of common allies in terms of political power. And I think this is also the first time in which we have common allies in terms of economic power. There are other people who are sort of experiencing the same sort of unfairness that a lot of minorities sort of grew up with and are shocked by it. And then all I can say is I welcome those allies. Like that's why we currently have so much power and why this has so resonance and why this is even in the most rural white parts of America. Guess what? They're uprising on this too. They hate this inequity also.
I think you're right. The election of Trump for a lot of people was very jaw-droppingly just unreal. I think so many people thought we had made such levels of progress with electing a Black man that come, you know, the election of Trump, which I think many people would have sworn that would have never happened. And I don't have the numbers, but just in perspective from reading the news and, you know, my own social affiliation, many people were shocked, but I think that that shock, there are enough people in this country who still align themselves with this white supremacist kind of mentality that Trump has put a platform up for. I think that those people are now less enamored with the America that we thought we had when Obama was in office. And so you're right. I think people are now saying that romanticization of progress, I think is, yeah, we've passed that.
I mean, for as bad as people think it is, this is the best it's ever been for minorities, which is, you know, saying a lot, right?
The crazy kind of irony to that too, though, is to your point, John, is that we're being reminded on a daily basis, though, and there's incident after incident that's being captured that's continuing to force everybody to a call to action. So if we think back about, you know, the 92 LA uprising and what happened with Rodney King, so that happens, right? And it's captured, and that's what everyone's rallying around. But it's one thing. And you could have gone, you know, days, weeks, months without anything else. But here we are with George Floyd that gets captured, and we see everything that's unfolding. And then, I mean, you can just go day by day to see what's the latest that's happening now. So I look at my news feed, okay, and just within the last week, so after George Floyd, now there's the Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta. And then right here in California, the thing that I'm floored by, I don't know how to process it, is with Robert Fuller and Malcolm Harsh, the two hangings, and Victor Valens and Santa Cruz and Palmdale. Yeah. And this idea that, you know, there doesn't seem to be any foul play, and that this is most likely a suicide, is what the authorities were saying. And so now, you know, it's being launched into a full investigation. But it seems as though, again, through technology and through the phones, the spread of information is happening so much faster that it's not as though we have any choice, it feels as though, but to take a call to action. Yeah. And that doesn't negate what you're saying, though, as far as, you know, the time and place that we're in now being better for minorities than it was 20 years ago, and how you wouldn't trade places with your parents. Those two things are happening at the same time.
The thing that's been really strange for me is that I didn't think this had a lot of potential, because it was a leaderless protest, right? Black Lives Matter is not one person negotiating for their side. Usually what happens is you have one person negotiating a peace. I will bring peace if you give me these concessions. And then the concessions are given. And then the side that gave concessions, the side in power, tries to figure out some technical way to say, we follow the concessions, but really we didn't. And I felt like you would then stop because you negotiated a peace. Whereas this has no leader, which is why, you know, I remember when Hillary Clinton was confronted by Black Lives Matter, and she was trying to explain to him, like, you shouldn't be interested in whether I'm with you. You should be asking me, what will I commit to you? What are my budgeting priorities? What are my policy priorities? Where do I put that in my list of things that I'm going to do right away? And then they're like, no, are you with us? You're not with us. And I used to make fun of Black Lives Matters, saying like, oh, it's a millennial protest. They're just saying, I'm unhappy, fix it. And you know what? It's fixing. I mean, you have the president today coming out and saying, I have these policing policies that I like to come out. You have Ted Cruz, staunch Republicans coming out, just trying to like say, will this appease you? Well, let me add more to the plate. Will this appease you? Well, let's add more to the plate. Will this appease you? And I think because for the first time, we haven't been negotiating down in a way in which the demands could be then ignored, that the side in power keeps offering more and more things, realizing that there's no temporary fix that's going to fix this. And I think now that, you know, people feel threatened that the next police shooting, guess what, will be out here again.
You have to give credit to millennials who have changed the protest model to one that has imagined more progress than I thought could happen in my lifetime. Now, unfortunately, at this point, the podcast died. But let me finish with two points. First of all, vote. Policing is local. The police are supervised by your mayor and sometimes in conjunction with a commission or a board. But at the end of the day, policing is supervised by your mayor. One of the reasons why change is happening so fast, where different areas can ban chokeholds, is that power was always available to the mayor. He just was more afraid of the police than he was of voters. So if you don't like how you are policed, vote your mayor and your city council out of office. Threaten them. Tell them. You're just not going to vote for them if you can't see a difference in how you're policed. How you are policed is reflected directly by how you and your neighbors vote. The second point is a little bit harder. Usually how race is handled in a large institution is that we largely ignore it. We treat every student as if they're exactly the same. That's what's called a colorblind strategy. It's safe, but there are ceilings to its effectiveness. If a particular demographic is not well served by an intervention, we just give them more of that service that continues to fail them, rather than modify the intervention to a specific demographic. Let me give you an example of what a non-colorblind intervention looks like. The tutoring lab has proven year after year to be the best intervention on campus to help students pass their math class. We know that men of color use our tutoring lab less than other demographics. There are studies that show that especially Black men ask for help less often than other demographics. So Scott thought, why not bring tutoring to the places on campus where men of color have mentorship and support? And one of those places are on our athletic teams. But now you have this issue of connecting Black students in sports. And there's a long racist history of associating Black students with athletics because, just as every other student population, Black students are diverse in their hobbies, abilities, goals, and associations. Scott wanted to bring improvement to the college, so he asked the African-American faculty and administrators if they would be offended if he sent tutors to the sports complex. And they were fine with it. He then went to the coaches and asked them if they would be comfortable with it. They embraced the intervention, and the coaches helped monitor and mentor the athletes to get tutoring. Now, this is still an open intervention that requires annual support in order for it to survive, but we see that it works great when given resources. I'd like to see Valley College grow into a place where we as faculty and administrators felt safe to build targeted interventions that are not colorblind, but respond to the particular needs of the community. I hope that these hard conversations about culture, race, and community create more teaching and collaboration moments without the fear of condemnation. Thanks for listening to our podcast.